people on the left might not like to hear this, that it's the neoliberal state in India that not only delivered growth, but actually provided public infrastructure, created a social safety net. All the educational gender outcomes actually all improved.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. A fascinating new book called A Sixth of Humanity, Independent India's Development Odyssey, examines 75 years of development in the world's most populous country, the successes and the failures and the compromises, and the ways in which India has defied many of our ideas of how development should happen. Now, the authors are Devesh Kapoor of Johns Hopkins University and Arvind Subramanian of the Peterson Institute, and of course, formerly Chief Economic Advisor to the Government of India. So when I spoke to them recently, I asked them about the successes, the challenges, and India's future. Devesh, what is this book? Is it history? Is it economics? Is it political science?
Well, it's all of the above and none of the above. It's both argument and history, but Arvind and I have been discussing this for a decade. You know, how should one think about economic development when new nations are formed and they also have to struggle simultaneously about nation and state building? You cannot artificially separate these. They run concurrently. And we know a range of countries that were doing well. I mean, look at the Soviet Union or Yugoslavia that fell apart. We know how many countries are racked by civil wars, conflict. You can see it around the world for right now. And it's because the nation building project was incomplete. So we wanted to write this story looking at how the choices that the political leadership faced in building a state and a nation, how that shaped economic development, but also how economic development in turn shaped the nation building and state building projects. And so the idea was that these are necessarily concurrent. And we were dissatisfied with some of the works that focus on either one or the other. So that was our attempt.
Just to add one more thing to what Devesh said, all young nations, as Devesh said, have this problem that, you know, it's not just about creating an economy, a market economy. It's also about nation building, creating order. But of course, in the Indian case, it is even more made even more challenging because of the particular ways in which Indian society has evolved over centuries, not just thinking, you know, take caste, for example. You know, caste is something that has crucially affected many choices made in India. Then there's patriarchy, how were gender relations handled? So essentially, we're trying to tell a story about how this young nation created an economy, tried to transform its society, and yet build a nation and build a state, and uniquely all through democratic politics. I mean, from day one, India had universal franchise-based democratic politics, which made the Indian experiment experience quite distinctive and unique in many ways.
Now, there's one version of this story which portrays this as a 75-year-long growth miracle. Does the statistics support that?
Not at all. You know, just flatly wrong. It is a growth success since about the mid-80s, for about 3.5-4 decades since then. It's been one of the most rapidly growing countries in the world. But for the first 30 years, from 1950 to 1980, it was not a growth miracle. It was anything but a growth miracle, because not only was growth slow, poverty was high and stagnant, educational attainment was weak and not growing very well. The economic and record, not just in the narrow sense of per capita GDP and growth, but in a broader sense of structural transformation, was very weak. Just one interesting point is that in the book, we compare India and China between 1950 and 1980. Everyone thinks of China as having raced ahead of India after the Deng reforms of 1978. But actually, between 1950 and 1980, China was a kind of mess politically and in terms of instability. And yet, during that period, it raced ahead of India already. So that already by 1980, on all indicators, China was ahead of India.
This is quite a strongly worded book at times, and this is a time when there are many polarized opinions. Is it possible with a book like this to have a constructive debate about where India is now and economically where it's going?
I think there's a phrase, there are none so blind who do not want to see. If facts are irrelevant to you, then of course, you know, whatever one writes is not going to change minds. But I think if one has a somewhat open mind, we hope that it'll make people think, hopefully a little differently, not just about India's past and what it did, why it did, where it worked, where it did not, but hopefully it makes one think about how to think better about the future. So we are very careful in not being prescriptive. That is not what the book is about.
Just to add to what Devesh said, I think the way we try and do that is, firstly, it's a very data-driven book, right? And so we like to think that our arguments followed from the data rather than from priors, one, yeah? Second, and this is something that, you know, Devesh has been amazing at, that we've read almost every document, especially Devesh, that the Indian government has produced for the last 75 years. So that we are looking, look at stuff and the discussions and the debates that happened at that point in time about which we're writing, rather than through the, you know, the filter of the retrospective gaze, which leads to distortions and things, right? And so that data-driven, document-driven, hopefully helps us, you know, avoid getting into traps. We are very critical of some of the things that the left did in India and what the right did in India as well. And as kind of proof of that, we've actually encountered at the end of the book, we've been as surprised as validated in some of our priors.
Now, there's an unusual word that you use quite a lot in the book to describe India's development, and that is precocious. It's precociousness, particularly in the idea that it got democracy. You could almost describe it at the wrong time, before mass industrialization. What caused that to happen? Why is it important to think about that?
Your question is particularly germane given the context of our times today. I mean, the challenge that India's political leadership faced is, here was a country that was incredibly diverse. It had been vivisected, creation of Pakistan, and it had to integrate 560 princely states. And what they really charted was a new way of thinking about nationhood, unlike the European experience, where it was built around a single language, single religion. Democracy was actually their key instrument of nation building, which is very distinctive from other things. The nation building is built around whatever, some common cultural traits, and then the democracy comes. But here, the democracy is your key instrument of nation building, so that everyone can buy into the project. That was the main thing. The inclusiveness was as much intrinsic as much instrumental.
So we think of the great Indian political achievement as having created and sustained democracy under these inhospitable conditions. But because of what Devesh said, the instrumental use of democracy led then to two, I think, surprisingly under-recognized achievements of India, which is to maintain a modicum of order in such a diverse and kind of potentially conflict-ridden society. So that's one thing, order. And the other thing is that to create a workable sense of nationhood. All nation building is problematic, provisional. But India, you know, because the regions were very diverse, federalism allowed us to get this balance between religions, languages, and so on. So I think the achievements of nation building and order are the instrumental counterparts to the intrinsic achievement of democracy.
I think one way to think about it is just look at the countries that were created from British India. Burma, Sri Lanka, Pakistan. Pakistan broke apart. Sri Lanka has had big civil war. Myanmar now, as we know, has been going through multiple rounds of civil wars. And India's neighbor, northern neighbor, Nepal, has, although it was not part of British India, but India's entire neighborhood has had deep internal conflicts. And it's not that India is not. I mean, we are clear, right? I mean, Kashmir and India's northeast are very much examples of incomplete nation building.
But in the book, you also cover, and this is your phrase, what democracy took away. What economic consequences to this adherence to democracy might have been second best?
There's a famous Hindi movie and there's a famous line. If you recite in India, everyone will think democracy is like being stuck in a tank full of oxygen and water. The water will not allow you to live. The oxygen will not allow you to die. And so democracy is a little bit like that. It gives and it takes. And there are two or three, I think, major ways in which I think you could argue that democracy was also came in the way of some better choices. The most classic example is land reform early on, when revolutionary societies achieved land reform by coercive force, but democracy did not allow that to happen in India. And also because the way in which the Congress Party was structured, composed of landed elites, kind of big land reform was not possible. And that immediately became an impediment to power, to development, to agricultural productivity, all of those things. So that's one example. The other thing which we emphasize a lot about democracy is that the state provided welfare before providing public goods. See, the way it took manifested itself in India was, for example, early on, the banking system and the pricing system were used as mechanisms for redistribution. So if you look at the chapter on banking in India, for example, the amount of credit that was given to the government or, you know, via these welfare schemes was huge. And the amount that was actually given as credit to the private sector for development was minuscule. And if you compare those numbers, so in India, for example, maybe 30% of the overall deposits were given for credit, whereas in China and Korea, the numbers were vast. So that's another way in which, you know, democracy and the pressures came in. The Indian fiscal state, for example, has been quite weak. You know, one of the surprises we found in the book was average deficits, fiscal deficits, say over the last 30, 40 years, have been amongst the highest in India. They're upwards of 11, 12% on average. Let me read out what a former economist said, that basically because there were so many vested groups, he says, where workings of a parliamentary democracy, where 100 and even 1,000 flowers have to be allowed to bloom, all led to a kind of eclectic melange where every policy of special pleading found a place.
Very clear example or consequence of is corruption. Election financing. India's today, India has about 3 million elections. It has more elections than the size of countries, right? From meaning for 3 million elected officials at the local level, state level, national. And it's highly competitive. You cannot have a democracy without elections. You cannot have elections without election financing. Where does that money come from? So it's not that corrupt politicians are all lining up their pockets. They are, many of them. But there is immense pressure to raise election financing. And we know now India is not exceptional. I think we should be more clear-eyed about that democracy has costs. And there are costs of the democracy. And just by invoking the democracy as a mantra that, you know, somehow all our problems are going to be solved, that's why we point out what it gave and what it sometimes took away.
When India had its first set of elections, the average gap between any two elections was 5 years. Today, the average gap between any two elections is about 10 to 11 months. So we're in kind of perpetual electioneering mode. And that's why Devesh's point about the election financing becomes so salient.
Now, in its early years, India's development was done by state planning. I mean, that was not unusual in the 50s and the 60s, was it? Many nations did exactly the same thing. But were there roads not taken at that time, which, with hindsight, would have helped India's growth?
Planning, most countries did, absolutely, you know. And, you know, whether it's the Soviet Union, whether it was China, many, many countries around the world. But I think there were one or two really distinctive things that India did. which other developing countries did not do. The most damaging one was what India did to its own private sector. Remember, planning came with protectionism and inward orientation, what we call import substitution, right? But the aim of import substitution was to, you know, favor domestic producers and give them, you know, protection against competition. But what India turned around and did was it disallowed foreign competition in several ways, like many countries did. But over and above that, it, you know, imposed either limits or taxes on the domestic private sector that basically crushed the domestic private sector. So the public sector was allowed to flourish, but the domestic private sector was crushed. So that's why we say in the book that to call India's first 30 years as planning and import substitution is very misleading because, you know, you don't simultaneously crush your private sector. And by the way, what Devesh said about corruption in election financing, I mean, the early origins was through this system of licensing and controls, whether on the external side or distinctively in India on the domestic side, is what created this. So that was one road taken, which should not have been taken. The road not taken, and I think I'll defer this to Devesh, was, of course, on the whole basic education and, you know, those things. So, Devesh, why don't you talk about that?
The thing that has really struck us, at least the first half century for the most part, the default political gestalt was a leftist orientation and statist. Statist, in any case, every political party in India is statist. It doesn't matter if you're on the right or left, broadly speaking. So what is really puzzling is, why did a left orientation not lead to much more emphasis on primary education and public health? And a classic example is the state of West Bengal, where the Communist Party ruled for 3 decades uninterrupted. The Communist parties around the world, they're not good in many things, but the one thing they're relatively better at is actually basic public goods like health and education. I mean, primary health. West Bengal just didn't. That is a puzzle. There was an excellent book by this great MIT political scientist, Myron Wiener, called The Child and the State in India, which really embarrassed Indian elites. Every Indian, as Arvind was saying, what we read, internal government report was saying, this is terrible, we have to do more. But this is where, because under the constitution, primary health, primary education are state subjects. They're not the central government. So here is a classic example of the failure at the state level, at the subnational level, which no society can progress without a strong foundation of primary schooling and public health.
I can hear listeners saying, listening to Devesh citing West Bengal, saying, see how selective the choice of these authors is. There's, after all, another left state which actually did very well on health and education, which is Kerala. So here's the puzzle, right? Arguably, the only state that did really well on health and education is Kerala, which is almost always, not always, it's alternated, but communism has been the Communist Party has been very politically powerful. So the puzzle is, why did one left-leaning party do it, but not another one in West Bengal? And there the answer, of course, is that Kerala had a very unique, distinctive history, you know, social movements, reform movements, and so on. So in Kerala, it was a combination of, you know, historical evolution, the social reforms that took place, along with the fact that these communist governments did play an important part.
West Bengal was an example because, you know, the right-wing states like Gujarat, like in North India, their record is, of course, even worse.
So I was going to ask you about this. You put a lot of emphasis in talking about the states in India in the book. And many of us who are outsiders conceive of India as a giant centralized administration. And many things, of course, are centralized. Why is it important to consider India's development through the lens of state government?
Many of the important sectors of the economy, like health, education, agriculture, law and order, are, or elect power, electricity, are all constitutionally within the mandate of state governments. The central government is always in the news, certainly until the 90s and so on, because it was a centralized state. Fiscally, politically, it was a centralized state. But constitutionally, many of these things were under the purview of state governments. So essentially, what happens is after, say, the 90s, after the reforms, all these development priorities become much more important. And simultaneously, India politically becomes less the monopoly of one party, and regional parties become very important. So the states become, very important to both, de jure, they were always important, but de facto, they became over time as India became reformed and politically became, regional parties became much more important. But here are two things, facts about the states that I think the average listener should be aware of in India. We have a line in the book, Devesh and I, which says that at least in terms of providing public goods and essential things, whatever the center did badly, the states did worse. So, for example, what Devesh said about basic education or public health, these are actually mandates of the state. And for a number of reasons, they've actually underperformed. Even agriculture, they've underperformed. Accountability mechanisms, corruption, arguably, are more challenging at the state level. That's the first point. But the second, on the bright side, the thing to note is that, this is something that surprised us. If you look at economic growth in India, after 1980, one-third of India grew at Chinese rates of growth and for as long as China. And these are not just the southern states. It also includes Maharashtra, Gujarat, and the state of Haryana. So broadly, peninsular India grew at Chinese rates of growth. So what this shows is that if states have the agency, they have the power to do bad in terms of not providing public goods, but they also have the agency to do good and kind of really deliver for its people.
Most states in India are larger than most countries. The state of Uttar Pradesh in North India, were it an independent country, would be the seventh largest country in the world. So it's just the sheer size of this. One thing we tried to grapple with, I don't think so we succeeded, was I think in economic development, we don't have a good theory or understanding of scale. We think about size, but not scale. And scale is not the same as size. When you scale up to that, these giants, and that is what is so distinctive about China and India, then how, what are the differences in and how you manage development, I think poses a distinctive set of questions and challenges.
How do you think about growth and development where you have, a central authority with political, economic power, fiscal power, and state governments, and then how federalism works, because federalism has both competitive elements, states competing with each other, because as Devesh said, they're all large, they can do this, that's a desirable thing. But you also need cooperation between the states, between the center and the states, to achieve a lot of outcomes. So the whole theory and practice of federalism and development is, I think, a highly understudied topic. And I think we in our book, as Devesh says, only scratch the surface of this via the Indian experience.
So whether at a state or a federal level, the more recent story of India, again, very much in common with a lot of developing countries, has been that turn to neoliberalism. However, it seems to have delivered aggregate growth that is much better in India. Can we say that it solved many of the problems that the early state planning era had left behind?
The answer is yes. People on the left might not like to hear that. It's the neoliberal state in India that not only delivered growth, but actually provided public infrastructure, created a social safety net. All the educational gender outcomes actually all improved after growth, whether it was neoliberalism or a combination of that and the growth that it delivered since 1980 and 1991 after the reforms, I think it's the combination of that too. See, essentially, economic growth has transformed India. I think there's no getting away from that. And it did it in many, many ways. One obvious one is, of course, economic growth. Second, of course, it provided the resources to allocate, for the state to allocate more. Less well understood is that when economic growth took off, the incentive for people to acquire education increased tremendously. And if they didn't get it from the state, they went and got it from the private sector. Maybe the most important is what Devesh actually documented in some earlier work of his, was that growth was amazing also in kind of breaking down some of the, you know, traditional undesirable links between caste and occupations. So it was like a grease that dissolved some of these things and allowed social change.
One of the core features of India for long, it was a desperately poor country. For 60 years, India had by far the largest number of poor people in the world, right? One of the striking things is the sharp decline in poverty. And surely one of the core development outcomes that we want to judge, you know, development is a decline in poverty. That doesn't mean that a lot of people still are very low income, still have at lead very precarious lives. But the sorts of destitution that marked the worst of Indian poverty in the first 40, 50 years, that has surely gone. I think the one thing that undoubtedly the critics of neoliberals are right is that inequality has increased sharply. It has increased across states and it has increased sort of inter-household. There were two ways that caste replicated across generations. One is occupation. Your occupation was your father's. So caste was very much occupation specific. What modernity and economic growth does is it creates new occupations which historically have no links to any caste. A computer programmer or a truck driver, I mean, two completely different. So that's one thing. But the one thing that has not changed is intermarriage. And we show that basically every group, religious, caste, no one wants intermarriage. And that is still a huge block in broader societal transformation.
Now, I want to ask you to finish up about two aspects of India today and in the near future. The first one is the identity of what India is. Internally, it was born as a secular, multicultural state. It was quite explicit about that. It seems to be moving away from that identity now. What impact do you think that is going to happen or have on India's progress and development?
On that, we come out, I think, pretty clearly that is a source of, you know, worry. Ironically, Nehru was considered the last Englishman in India, the Europhile, Anglophile, etc. But they chose a model very distinctive from the European model of nation building. And the current political dispensation, which tries to say we are not that, is ironically choosing a nation-building model that is very European, which is, you know, single religion, single language. We believe that if not done very, very carefully, can create the very schisms that have been avoided and have been one of India's big achievements, which is macro order. A broad sense, India has lots of micro disorders that we show very clearly, but a broad sense of macro order. And when we look around the world, what is happening, I think India should be far more aware of the risks of doing things that can create that macro disorder.
The Indian federal structure, for example, is very critical for how India is going to shape in the future. But then if that is, jeopardized because of, you know, friction between the states and the center, which is happening now to a greater extent, some because of language and other things. So the broader, I think, lesson is that order, nation building, strong institutions, these are big achievements that if you, undermine them in any way, the risks will be not just to economics. If you have, you know, weak regulatory institutions, obviously economic outcomes will suffer. But the risks are much broader than that. As we've seen around the world, you could have a much more serious conflict, much more serious disorder. And those in turn will be bad for everything. Once you get into this, your economic things will be the least of your worries, I think.
I also wanted to ask you about India's external stance as well, which I believe is, in the jargon, multi-alignment now. And we were made very aware of that, perhaps in Europe and North America. We didn't think about it very much until we saw Modi standing next to Putin and Xi in Shanghai. Again, what effect do you think this will have on India's development and its progress?
That picture was in many ways forced on him by the Trump tariffs. No political leader in India will have the survival probability of a snowball in hell if you cave in to an external pressure. I mean, India knows that it has a weak hand, actually. Its biggest external competitor, security challenge is to its north and east, that is China, which is much stronger economy, stronger military. It cannot antagonize it too much. Russia is a weak hand. You know, after all, you cannot expect much from Russia either, and it's increasingly aligned with China. It thought it had really succeeded in building strong relations with the US. And to be fair to the prime minister, he had done his hardest to win over Trump. And then in a whimsical or whatever way, that all got, the carpet was just yanked away. And that would be added to that is the new H-1B visa thing, which, as you know, affects Indians and the Indian IT sector way more than any other country.
You have to engage with the world. You have to be open and embrace the world. You know, independence and autarky is not a solution. And the experience of India shows that whenever it has been more open, its economic growth has also been good. But we've reached a stage where I think we need to be interconnected, but we also have to minimize the risks of either over-dependence, either on countries, markets, military suppliers, technologies. Spurn no suitor. For example, what India is doing now very nicely, with this, negotiating agreements with the UK, now with the European Union, maybe getting closer. And in India, there's talk of saying, look, we may have a problem, a security problem with our neighbor, but we need China's whatever capital, some technologies, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it's a much more nuanced way. You're no longer in the neoliberal world of saying openness is unambiguously good. You have to be open, you have to have domestic capability, and you have to engage with the world in a way that minimizes these over-dependencies. And I think that's the, broader way of looking at what India has to do.
This is a book that tells us a great deal about India, but it's also telling us a great deal about development in general and some of the challenges that everyone is facing at the moment. Thank you very much for talking about it today. Thank you, Devish.
Thank you.
And Arvind as well.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
So a reminder, that book is called A Sixth of Humanity, Independent India's Development Odyssey. It is published by HarperCollins India, authors, of course, Devish Kapoor and Arvind Subramanian. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you never miss an episode is to follow us. You find us wherever you get your podcasts. And remember that all our past episodes are at voxdev.org, where you also find articles about the topics we feature. And if you like what you're hearing, please tell someone else about us.